Welcome to Nurse Educator Podcast. I'm Marilyn Armin, Editor-in-Chief of Nurse Educator. With me today are Maureen Hillier, who teaches at Curry College and MGH, Massachusetts General Hospital Institute for Healthcare Professions, and Becca Lewis, who's an actor and a standardized patient in the Boston area. Becca and Maureen, thank you so much for joining us to share your virtual end-of-life simulation and to provide guidelines for faculty who may want to do this themselves in their own program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Could you start out by describing your virtual end-of-life simulation? And I think this is what our listeners will be interested in.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to tackle the description of our the virtual end-of-life simulation. So basically, we are a program in the Boston area. It's an accelerated Bachelor of Science program. These are fourth semester students, and we have about 10 students per group, and we repeat it 10 times to reach a total of 100 students. So our students do the traditional pre-brief, some homework that's assigned to sort of, you know, give them a little bit of a preview of, you know, that this is a difficult topic, this whole end-of-life topic. So they always have the opportunity to opt out if things become too difficult. And we always start with the basic assumption, knowing that they're smart, well-intentioned students hoping to do their very best to learn. And then after that, you know, after we assure some psychological safety and do our pre-brief and rules of engagement and confidentiality clauses, we launch into the simulation in the virtual space. Our platform that we use was Zoom, and we use some of the functionality, including break rooms, for this. But in the first sort of, there's almost six or seven sort of steps to this. And so probably the best way to do it is sort of describe how we progress from one step to the other. So first, the students meet Charlie in a video. And this is just a video that we lifted off of the internet of a 76-year-old man. And we named him Charlie, who lives with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease with a nasal cannula in his nose, and telling about his quality of life. And then the second phase would be that we now read a scenario about Charlie and show a static picture of a man in some respiratory distress. Next, after we read the scenario, we ask the students to go into a team huddle to identify three priority assessments with what they would want to do to provide care for Charlie for that day. And then they come back and we review that. So once again, this is 10 students, so all of them are in the team huddle engaged in sort of identifying priority assessments. So we only give them about 5 minutes for that, otherwise they get a little sidetracked. And then the fourth step is about a one-minute video of an elderly man in significant respiratory distress now because he does have a COVID-19 diagnosis. So the students watch that video, we watch it with them, and then they actually go into a second team huddle to re-identify and strategize and prioritize sort of now what are your going to priority assessments going to be this time. And so we allow the students to have some discourse and sort of engage in some good critical thinking conversations about how this patient will be managed. And towards the natural end, as that conversation and that team huddle is winding down, we actually have, we put through a phone call from the patient's daughter and asking them to accept a Zoom call. And she's a daughter that lives about 1,000 miles, and she's basically comes on the phone. It seems a little abrupt to the students, but we ask, during the previous team huddle, we have three students self-identify who will be taking, who will be actively engaged in the next segment of the simulation, but without telling them exactly what's going to happen. And so those three students, the other seven students, hide their Zoom video and take this phone call from the standardized participant, which is our professional actress, Becca, who, does a great job asking for an update on her father, wants to, you know, have an update and want to know what are the next steps to expect. And then she does typically throw in a difficult question, like, what would you do if this was your dad? And so it's a powerful simulation. And then from there, we go into our debriefing, which is the three-step model that we use according to, you know, NACS standards of best practice with the emotional release, the medical understanding, and then sort of final takeaway points to sort of guide and give some structure to our debriefing. But at all points, students are given the opportunity to opt out if it becomes too difficult. So that's a quick synopsis of the simulation, Dr. Orman.
During the pandemic, were your students allowed at clinical sites, or is this why you shifted? Did you shift the simulation from an in-lab one to a virtual one because of the pandemic?
We have to do some planning because we are uncertain if our students would be allowed in the clinical sites. Because we're part of a big system with Mass General, we did have some partners that allowed our students to absolutely actually continue on in clinical, but this is sort of planned simulation time that was planned to be taking place face-to-face. So this is why we launched it into the virtual platform.
And Becca, you were the standardized patient for this virtual end-of-life simulation, which I understand you did via Zoom. Do you have some specific Zoom recommendations to increase authenticity or fidelity, as well as the student's investment?
Sure. One of the things I love about this simulation is that we're not asking students to suspend disbelief in any kind of major way. We're not pretending that we're all in the same room. They know this is a video call. And having the given circumstances be an update to a family member who's thousands of miles away is a very real likelihood during a pandemic. So they were all able to easily step into their roles as well as the urgency of the situation. And then from a technical standpoint, Dr. Hillier mentioned this earlier, we have folks who are not participating in the simulation turn off their video. And we also have everyone hide non-video participants, which is all very technical Zoom speak, but it really makes it look and feel like it's a Zoom call between the participants and creates the maximum amount of intimacy available in this format. And it's also challenging for a conversation like of this kind to come to a natural end. So Dr. Hillier would simply turn her video on to stop the sim and then ask everybody else to turn their videos back on for a debrief altogether.
About how long did it take for each simulation?
We allocated about, I think it was 2.5 hours for the sim with the pre-brief work and laying down some safe, you know, rules of engagement and opportunities to opt out. And so between reviewing the homework and the sim itself, the sim, there's different phases of the sim, like watching the video and then going into a huddle. But all things considered, we earmark about 2.5 hours. For this, oftentimes it went over because students actually had a lot to unpackage. It was interesting. I can recall one student saying he had about 17 deaths working as a clinical assistant in the last month. So they were just sort of, you know, had entered the clinical arena and had a lot of scary things that they'd witnessed kind of for the first time. Now that might be more the exception than the rule, but other students sort of started to share stories of what they were seeing either in their clinical rotations or working as a clinical assistant as they geared up for their graduation, which was just weeks away.
This is a simulation that you and Becca, the standardized patient, really worked collaboratively to develop the sim, to implement the simulation via Zoom. What was your collaboration process? Could you explain this to our listeners?
Sure. At the beginning, once we knew that we couldn't be in person, Maureen and some other standardized patients and I had a video call to discuss how we could keep the learning objectives of the sim without being in the same room. And there was a lot of discussion about, you know, what we could do from my home. Could we make my home look like a hospital and I could be the patient? Though, as we've discussed, having the students work the least hard to imagine the circumstances became a priority. And we asked ourselves, how can we make this as realistic as possible under these circumstances? And what is being thrown at these folks in the field in this actual format?
And I think it was really novel, too. I think the way Becca, if I could just share that sometimes, you know, I think maybe you had something simple like your cat or a favorite pet kind of come near the screen. You know, we kept it as real as possible. Sometimes I think the daughter might have had a child in the simulation where you had to pause the simulation to talk to your child and then come back. So Becca did a great job of sort of providing some improv that was relative to how the students were pacing, sort of engaging the sort of rhythm of what was going on in the simulation, just to keep it real.
And I would think that that would keep it real for the students. I can see why you did that. I'm curious, for this type of simulation, why is the standardized patient or actor feedback so critical?
Sure, I can answer that. So I think that as actor, feedback has this delightful effect of being able to speak in first person. For example, I could say, you know, when you said that this must be so scary, I felt like you were really considering the fear of this moment, the impossible struggle of being so far away as my father is actively dying. And this first person feedback is so different from talking about empathy and how important empathy is in a didactic way. Students also can ask me how things landed immediately after if they're worried about how something came across. And this kind of feedback can only be done when you have the actor actively participate in the debriefing.
I think with students experiencing so much stress in their clinical, as you mentioned, those students who were doing extender work in the hospital, but now as they go back to clinical and really caring for these really ill patients, I would think this simulation is a critical one for schools to build in their curriculum. I don't know if you had any comment about that. I don't think we do enough with end-of-life simulation these days.
I would agree, Dr. Orman. We've done some research because Becca and I actually also run this for new graduates at Boston Children's Hospital. And through my doctoral research, which is the focus of this work, really the impetus that got it going, there's a huge dearth of curriculum content that's either missed or reached. Sort of shield students from in the academic arena. So we know we're graduating a workforce that perhaps might not be ready to deal with end of life. And so I think both of us would strongly believe that there's a place for this in the undergraduate curriculum. Because after all, who spends more time with dying patients than the discipline of those in nursing?
Right. What are your next steps?
I think our next steps are to collect some more evaluative data. And maybe even add a student reflection or journaling reflection, like a critical reflective inquiry after this learning assignment. And then we definitely feel like we're onto something, especially going through a pandemic now, is maybe doing some longitudinal studies, like checking in with these simulation participants maybe 3 months or 6 months after the learning experience to see if they've had some knowledge gain that they're actually able to hold on to and apply into the world of practice.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today for this podcast and sharing this really important, these guidelines and your experiences with this virtual end-of-life simulation. This concludes the podcast.